something, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, and we air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. As always, we are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're talking with Professor Shilpa Dave. Dave is an assistant professor of media studies and American studies at the University of Virginia and assistant dean in the College of Arts and Sciences. She researches and teaches about representations of race, gender, and media and popular culture, American cultural narratives of immigration, Asian American and South Asian American studies in film, television, and literary studies. She's published on topics ranging from teaching Asian American studies to No Life Without Wife, Masculinity, and Modern Arranged Meetings for Indian Americans, to Apu's Brown Voice, Cultural Inflections in South Asian Accents, and the comic series Spider-Man India. Can't wait to talk about that. Check out all our past shows on the station website at 947wpvc.org. Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I am.
Cool. I feel like I heard call waiting. I don't know. Did you hear that? On the line.
I did, actually. Do you have
someone's
another guest host in another studio who's got questions for Shilpa other than me?
No. I think we suffice. And Shilpa has quite a lot we can talk about, so I'm really excited to talk about that.
Yeah, so I hear we're a guest down, apparently.
Yeah, well, no one needs to know. So far, this gentleman.
I don't mind going behind the curtain.
Okay. Behind the curtain, we're scheduled to have Dr. Michael Williams. He may still come. It is a little difficult to find the studio, although my map to the studio, I've been told, is amazing. Anyhow, so.
I didn't know you were a cartographer. Is that the.
Yes. Perfect.
I'm way out of my depth. I don't watch enough Antiques Roadshow, but I thought that's the word for you, a cartographer.
It is.
There you go.
So, can we get right to...
it's obviously not your fault.
No, clearly.
No.
But can we get right to this NRA Kremlin tie and guns? I mean, from an NPR story, we just learned a prominent Kremlin-linked Russian politician has for years, like 6 years, he's recorded his progress on leveraging connections to get deep, deep access into American politics through the NRA. And then the FBI, of course, has been investigating whether this particular guy named Torshin has illegally funneled money to the NRA to assist the Trump campaign in 2016.
Can you believe how long this is taking? I mean, the House has been on fire. Let's say February. I'm being gracious. I'm giving them a month where you couldn't really connect the dots, even though you could. But regardless, I mean, why is this taking so long? Why are the Republicans so? I mean, I know why. You don't have to answer. I mean, you can, if I would shut up. But you know, they are so dead set on not opening their eyes to this. We are at such a national security risk. I mean, I don't even know if it's repairable ever.
Right. It is scary, scary, scary. I thought you were going to say why the justice is taking so long. I think that it takes long to prove a good case. I think that's not what you meant, and I agree totally.
Exactly,
I know. It's
right.
The complicity.
Congress. I mean, get him out of there.
Yeah, the complicity and how deep they are in either with Russians or the NRA or both. Like, it's unexplainable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're in every, well, and I'm sure there's more. I'm sure we're going to learn more.
Yeah,
that they've managed to get into all the nooks and crannies, and position themselves to, you know, to leverage as many people, so that they continue to just we're a satellite of Russia. I mean, it's just it's unbelievable.
It is. So a little
bit of Nukes video, you know, the one, he has nothing to say about that. The guy,
right.
You know,
no response.
Which is not the NRA piece of it, but it's more of,
it's a Russian piece. I was wondering what the motive was for Putin to do that. I mean, first of all, it's an old video, right? It's not even new.
Apparently some of the clips are very old. Yeah.
The cartoon. Why is why is he flexing now? I mean, that's great as far as let's get people more against Russia, the people who are blinded
to it. Speaking of a cartographer, he could use a cartographer on that one. But,
and a Photoshop
artist. My uneducated guess is simply he's, as they say, he's emboldened. He can do whatever he wants. We don't even have the sanctions in. So why not just tell the rest of the world how awesome he is? You know, he's not going to get any pushback, apparently.
That's right. So one of the things
I'm getting unglued.
I know. It's disgusting. The gun laws, though, I was reading a little bit about how other countries operate in the realm of guns. I know a lot of us have talked about Australia and how they've cut their gun deaths in half by the buyback program that they did. But also a lot of other countries have sensible gun laws. Like in Japan, you have to attend classes, pass a written test, mental health evaluations at a hospital. You have to retake the class that after an initial exam on shotguns every 3 years. I mean, it just goes on and on. South Africa, you have to pass a review of criminal behavior. You have to pass a history of domestic violence and drug abuse kind of, you know, test. Then they interview your family and neighbors. Austria, you have to prove you're in serious physical danger before you can get a handgun or a semi-automatic rifle, and pass a review of criminal history. And then once you buy the gun, then you have to wait 3 days before you can come and pick it up. So, I mean, it's not rocket science here.
No, I mean, we could certainly follow by example, since apparently we can't lead, you know, would think. All this homework has been done, but I know we're not doing any of it.
So today, though, let's talk about something a little happier. We're going to celebrate in Charlottesville the second annual commemoration of Liberation and Freedom Day, is what it's called, recognizing the ending of slavery in Charlottesville and Albemarle County. And that's an all-day celebration today. It began at 9. From 11 to 1:30, there's a celebration at the Jefferson School African-American Heritage Center with lunch and festivities. And right now, if you want to catch this podcast and go, I don't blame you. If you want to go to the Freedom March at the UVA Chapel.
Are you going to stick around? Because I don't have the buttons over here. So, as long as you don't listen to the podcast later, I'm good with that.
I'm going to be here. So this Freedom March starts now, and it goes from the chapel at UVA to the Jefferson School African-American Heritage Center. And there's been a lot on Facebook about it. It looks like it's going to be very well attended and a lot of fun and a worthy cool. celebration.
That sounds excellent.
Yeah.
Anything with festivities, you can't sell that word short. I do like that word. No, that's great. I'm glad they're doing that. It's a great way to spend a Saturday. So
yes.
Goodbye to all our listeners, and you and I will continue that with Shilpa.
Okay. A lot of people catch the podcast, you know, that's what I'm finding. Re-mention those marches back to the shooting, the guns, March 24th, March on Washington, April 20th. Is the walkout nationwide, hopefully. And I am not racist.
Don't forget March 14th.
Am I?
That's 17 minutes. Oh, you were on that.
I'm not racist, am I? I just want to say I'm not declaring that because if you watch the film, all white people are racist, which I tend to agree with. But that film is being shown just two more times in this community, March 6th, March 16th. You can find that online everywhere.
Okay, and then March 14th, the National School Walkout. I'm done.
Yes, March 14th, National School Walkout.
Yeah, they're taking the 17 minutes for the 17 lives.
Yeah, good. Thanks. Forgot that one.
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to turn the page on the notes I had on guest number one. And go to guest number two, who I'm really excited.
Speaking of gun news, unless were you just about to introduce Shilpa, I don't want to.
Well, go ahead. We have a minute.
I've been meaning to ask you, I noticed I read that the Virginia House approved a stop gun violence license plate. This is apparently what we're capable of. You know, we can do that.
Yeah.
Is that true? Did you hear about that? They passed, or the objection of the GOP majority leader.
No, but to that I say. No, I didn't. That's good. I mean, I don't know.
It's nothing, but it's something,
it's
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's at least it's not the NRA license plate.
That's true.
I saved it.
That's true.
I can turn that frown upside down.
Yes.
No, the other way. Please.
Okay.
Excuse me.
I introduce Shilpa Dave? Are you ready for this, Nance?
I am.
Okay,
I've already scooted down to my second tier of questions. I'm
okay.
All set.
I was saying to her before we started that we could really use a whole hour on everything that she's accomplished and researched and what she knows, because we had a little pre-interview and she's chock full of information. So I'm really actually really excited. Let me introduce her to you all. Shilpa Dave is an assistant professor of media studies and American studies at the University of Virginia. She's also assistant dean in the College of Arts and Science. Dave focuses on representations of race and gender in media and popular culture, American cultural narratives of immigration and border crossings, comparative American studies, including Asian American and South Asian American studies in film, television, and literary studies. She's published on topics ranging from teaching Asian American studies to No Life Without Wife, Masculinity in Modern Arranged Meetings for Indian Americans, also Apu's Brown Voice, Cultural Inflection and South Asian Accents, the comic series Spider-Man India, and Model Minorities. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about what she means by model minorities and the spelling bee. So welcome to the show, Shilpa.
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you, Nancy. I'm delighted to be here. And I'm happy to talk about anything related to popular culture. And of course, popular culture, I think, is related to a lot of the social issues and political issues that's going on today. So let's get to it.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about Sunday's Oscars. I know that's really interesting to you, and it's a cultural moment, I think. Tell us about the nominated films this year and what your take is on this cultural moment.
Well, a couple of years ago, the Oscars decided to increase the number of pictures that they could nominate for Best Picture. And so this is, I think, the first year that they really went up almost to the max of 9 pictures nominated for Best Picture. And so there's a wide variety, and I think it does reflect some of the issues that we're talking about in today's culture. And it reflects also the new members that came about because of the Oscars So White movement that happened in 2015 and 2016. The Academy actually added 800 new members, and 39% of those were women, and 30% were non-white members. And one of the things that is interesting is that even in the Academy, the majority of members are actors. So they're the ones who are going to be voting for their highest picks and the nominations, as well as the winners too, as well. And so we've got a wide variety of films that reflect everything from race, gender, sexuality, history. So, and I think out of these 9, and it's hard, I think, for people to see 9 pictures. I'm lucky, I've seen all of them. So these days, what's dominating the media is, of course, Black Panther, which is not eligible because it came out in February. Last year at this time, the film that came out was Get Out, and that created a big stir. And this year, it's nominated for Best Picture. So it's one of the 9. And so there are some great pictures. The ones right now that people are sort of looking at in terms of the front runners are The Shape of Water, 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and the other ones that people have been talking about is Get Out and Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm. Has this been a trend in the last just couple of years? Because we had Moonlighting. Was it Moonlight?
Moonlight, yeah.
Moonlight, sorry. That was an 80s sitcom with...
Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis.
Bruce Willis, yeah.
It snuck in.
You could probably tell us about that dynamic as well, I'm sure. But is this a trend in the last couple of years? Have you seen this coming? Or why is this happening now?
I do think it's in response to what happened in 2015 with Oscar So White. Right. That people are realizing that... the films aren't reflecting the people who are going to films. And, studios are, at the end of the day, they're interested in their profit margins. That's what makes them go. And so they want to be able to attract different audiences for their blockbusters. And then when they get money for the blockbusters, it allows studios to then funnel other funds to do some of their special project films. And I think... in both the cases of nowadays, the blockbusters that are coming out, but also the smaller films and the smaller projects, you are seeing more racial and gendered and class diversity. That's really reflecting some of the political situation. I mean, one of the interesting things about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is it's experiencing this resurgence because it really is talking about the small, small white town in Missouri. And it's also, really featuring this warrior woman who is asking for justice. So as you know, people have been talking about Harvey Weinstein and sexual harassment. The Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement is really talking about how women can ask for justice and how also women are coming out to speak their stories. And so I think one of the resurgence that is coming about from Three Billboards is because of the character of Frances McDormand, who's a mother who wants justice for the unsolved murder of her daughter. And so we're really getting a strong contemporary woman who is able to articulate her sense of injustice, and it resonates with a lot of different people. And I love the superhero movies, and I love The Shape of Water, which is this lovely modern day fairy tale, which is also about tolerance and difference too as well. The character that Frances McDormand plays, I think, does speak to this strident, strong, and perseverant woman who works against injustice.
So do you think, is it enough for this diverse bunch of nominees? Is it enough that they were nominated? How do you think women and people of color will fare? What's your impression on tomorrow?
Well, I think, as I just said, there are 9 films, and I think that they actually will do really, really well. I mean, Get Out is Jordan Peele's original screenplay, which is a play on the horror film, and really talking about this idea of this sublimated consciousness. You have an interracial relationship that's talked about in the film, but then also sort of the fear of Black America when they're going into, a situation where they're the only one. And I think it really is a touchstone to some of the social interactions that we're looking at when you have a meeting of different races. And it hits at us in really interesting ways because it's the idea of horror that he's looking at, which is and there's comedic elements in that too as well, but it also is this idea that it's touching something that's uncomfortable in us.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Shilpa Dave. She researches and teaches about representations of race and gender in media. We'll be right back, and we'll talk more with Shilpa about much more. Welcome back, everyone, to Apropos of Something. We are talking with the wonderful Shilpa Dave. She is a teacher at University of Virginia in media studies. She talks about race, gender, and the media. And we've been talking about the Oscars, and we were just, before we had to go to break, we were just talking about Get Out. If you want to continue what you were saying about that, Shilpa.
Well, I think Get Out is really a wonderful film, and Jordan Peele wrote the screenplay, and I'm hoping that he wins an Oscar for the best screenplay. And I think one of the reasons why is because he takes a genre like the horror film, and he plays with all the different tropes, including, thematic foreshadowing to looking at consciousness and also looking at deep-seated fears. I mean, I love it that he appeals to a crossover audience because a lot of different people can go to this film and put themselves in different positions too as well. And so at one sense, it's some of the awkward moments of, parties where people ask about, your race, or they make different kinds of comments, to the idea of celebrating the TSA agent and best friend who comes to his rescue. And so I think, I'm hoping that Get Out does get the best screenplay. And I know, Nancy, you were asking, well, how are we going to see diversity, come through? And I think it's not just through the best picture. And even the best picture has, there's a wide variety. There's The Post, which is talking about social issues and investigative reporting and the importance of that. And given our current climate, I think it's appealed to a lot of people. Plus, we have superstars like Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks talking about issues. But we also have lovely independent films like Lady Bird, which is really talking about sort of mother-daughter relationships, too, as well. And so when we talk about how are women going to be represented, as well as how we look at issues related to race and issues related to class, I think this is where we really we are getting a lot of diversity. Call Me By Your Name is a lovely summer romance in Italy between two men, and it ends with a happy ending. Sometimes you get stories that are looking at you know, racial issues or issues related to sexuality, and they have these dark endings where someone you know, ends up dead or, you know, is completely heartbroken. But these all, you know, these particular stories, I think, give us a variety of different ways. Not that everything has to be a happy ending, but I think one of the things I love about Call Me By Your Name, which is about a romance between an older man and a younger man in Italy, is that the parents of the younger man, when this relationship breaks up, they're so loving. And so you're seeing these loving relationships between men, including fathers and sons. So when you talk about diversity and how it's represented in different films, I think this is what you see across the board. And the, right now, one of the top films is The Shape of Water. And as I said, that's a sort of a modern day fairy tale. What you have is you have this notion of tolerance and difference and really exploring the nature of love and empathy. But it also has, you know, a multidimensional portrayal of disability, where the main character, Sally Hawkins, is she's mute. And so how does she look how does this communication happen between, you know, an equine sort of creature of the Black Lagoon and a woman who works in the secret facility, and where her colleague is played by Octavia Spencer, who has already won an Oscar for her role in The Help.
So before, I know you're here for a while, but I just, before we move on to other things you've written and you're about TV and culture beyond the movies, I am curious, though, what is your pick? What is your hope for Best Picture? And what do you think will win?
My hope for Best Picture would be Get Out. What I think will win will be Shape of Water.
Mm. And why
is that?
Jinx.
Sorry.
I just think
the shape of agreeing.
I just think that Get Out really does, you know, break the genre barriers and is another method and another narrative storytelling way of really pointing at racial issues across cultures, but particularly across our American culture, of how we think and talk about race, and really sort of sheds a spotlight on the different interactions and the different kinds of relationships we can have. And so I just think it's about this idea of, I think I mentioned this before, the sublimated consciousness of how race shows us our different kinds of interactions, our social interactions that we have.
So you told me you've seen all 18 Marvel films.
Yes.
Right? So I want to talk about Marvel films and comics, but for the films, how has the superhero changed since those first films?
Well, I think it's interesting because if you want to, you can think of Shape of Water as a sort of superhero film, too, as well, with the Sally Hawkins character being one of the people who helps, you know, create the. It has this fantasy element about it, too, the science fiction fantastical element. And I think that when we think about superhero films, and particularly all of the hoopla around Black Panther, what people will be talking about, and I think this is what will be interesting at the Oscars, is I'm sure they'll be talking about the Me Too and the Time's Up movement, but because Black Panther is on its way to being a billion-dollar movie worldwide within less than a month of its release, people are going to be talking about Black Panther. Mm-hmm. And I think what it shows behind the scenes is that we have African-American producer, we have an African-American director, we have writers, costumers, you know, cinematographers, different people who are creating this vision of what a global Black culture looks like, as well as also talking about African-Americans, too, as well, because the villain is African-American, and really representing sort of different issues related to how we look at race worldwide, but also how we're thinking about it in terms of an American context. And so there's dialogues going on about the ways in which we're thinking about Blackness, but also racialized culture, too, as well. The other powerful thing about the Black Panther is it's a crossover film. It is appealing to a wide audience that is, you know, demographically diverse, from young people to older people, men, women, people of all races and of all countries, too, as well. And so it's not just a national phenomenon. It is a worldwide phenomenon. I was just looking earlier this week, and it's in like the top film, and particularly the English speaking film, in countries all over the world, from, you know, Australia to Singapore. It hasn't premiered in China yet, so we don't know the numbers in China yet. But across the world, people are watching this film.
Do you think other cultures and races, people are identifying with this and taking this as their own sort of beacon and superhero? You know, like Asians Americans, or it's big in China, people who feel oppressed there, or people here who feel oppressed, other races. Do you know what I'm trying to get at? Do you think they're getting behind this film? Is that the reason?
I think so, because at the end of the day, it's a really well-made film. It is a great story. Universally, it's talking about, look at this advanced culture that has these smart, intelligent, technologically advanced people. And their dilemma is to think about, well, do we reveal ourselves to the world and continue sort of, or do we maintain our culture as it is in isolation? Yes, we're protected, but we aren't interacting with the problems and the issues that are happening in the world around us. And that's one, the villain, Eric Killmonger, I mean, part of his impetus, besides, you know, the backstory of, you know, mythical backstory, actually, of that they're actually cousins, and he's been the outsider cousin who is suddenly discovered. Part of the argument they're having is that he's saying, where were you? I needed to see, you know, what your culture had to offer, not only as family, right, but also that we could see a strong, proud, intelligent African-American culture that could help us lead the way, because we need leadership. We need to see models of things and people that we admire. And so I think one of the reasons why the superhero movies are so popular, especially since 2000, is we are looking for heroes. We are looking for people that we can see as role models, you know, outside of our own families. And this is, I think, before we used to look to politicians or war heroes. And there's this idea of everyone keeps on saying we need a hero, we need a hero. And I think that term is used a lot. And I think we also need to go back to this idea of what a mythic hero is. And superheroes allow us to play out a lot of our social issues, but also for us to dream about what someone who's admirable can really, really do, and how villainy and evil can be faced down in a way that in a film, anyways, for 2 hours, you know, that there is a beginning and an end. Though with the Marvel universe, as you said, this is one of a series of films that have been going on that have started since that started in 2004 with Iron Man, and so they're really building this universe with all of these different heroes.
It is nice and refreshing that as a black film, it is it is a blockbuster. It is a comic. You know, it is not a historical look at slavery, you know, which is the only way Hollywood mostly has, you know, allowed us to think about race. It's usually a film that has historical context. So I am so glad it's breaking all box office numbers, which I know matters, you know, because I'm hoping that this is not one isolated, well, it doesn't sound like it is. I think they've already signed on for five more already. So that this is not an anomaly, you know, that this becomes more commonplace. It's just a black superhero, you know.
And there have been black superheroes in the past. I mean, there's Robert Townsend's Meteor Man.
No, I know, but on this level, on this scale. On
right.
This,
and it started with actually on TV with Luke Cage, which is, again, another some of the Marvel spinoffs that Netflix has been doing, too, as well. But I agree with you. And it's actually, there are two points. That one is that the director, Ryan Coogler, actually is one of the directors who's actually made a contemporary film about
right.
African-Americans, which was Fruitvale Station,
yeah. Yeah.
which I think
yeah.
more and more people need to see because it is about the day in the life of a black man who lives in San Francisco. And yes, it's based on a true story that I think is brilliant. And then he did Creed, which was a different take in the Rocky series. And now he's able to do this. But I would say, although slavery isn't necessarily, American slavery isn't necessarily a narrative here, what the narrative is about colonialism. And that's about worldwide hierarchies and slavery. So it is there, but it's in a slightly different way, because that's where the argument is, how did this civilization develop in Africa? A place that is a continent that has been marked by colonialism. And so the fictional kingdom of Wakanda is actually in East Africa, in the sort of between the Congo and Uganda. And so that becomes sort of, again, this part of this central argument. But as you said, this film is layered. There are so many different ways that you can interact with this film. And one of the reasons that people are saying they want to go and see it again and again is because they're going to see different things every time they go. And not only is the story great, but it's beautiful. The film is shot beautifully. The clothing is beautiful. And they have these four amazing women in the film. So although the title character is Black Panther, he is advised by these four amazing women, and then there are also these amazing men too as well. So it really does give us a great story that is about sort of projecting again the Marvel universe, but it's also about, you know, looking deeply into, you know, what does a brother-sister relationship look like, what does a mother-son relationship look like, who is it with the father figure. And so Black Panther gives us a lot of narrative and a lot of story to talk about.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We are talking with Shilpa Dave, who talks about race and gender in media and popular culture. We're going to continue talking with her. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone, to Apropos of Something. We have a new guest in the studio, Dr. Michael D. Williams. We're going to talk to shortly, but I wanted to just wrap up our interview, really interesting, with Shilpa Dave. Just because we only have a minute left, tell me about the reboot that you've thought about with Marvel Comics.
So what Marvel Comics has done, I think, in because of the new editor that they've had, and this is in the print version, is Sana Aminat, is that they've been able to look at new audience, try to generate new audiences that are really looking at different communities of color. And so African-American, Latinos, and Asian-Americans. And they've put together these new mythologies related to Spider-Man, who's Miles Morales, who is Afro-Latino, the Hulk, who is Korean-American, and the biggest star is Ms. Marvel, who's Kamala Khan. She's a Pakistani-American who is growing up in Jersey City. And so the hope is when Ms. Marvel, the movie, comes out next March, that Kamala Khan will make an actually, it's Captain Marvel is the movie with Carol Danvers. Carol Danvers will be the key character. Is that the hope is that Ms. Marvel will make an appearance too. So not only are we getting African Americans, but we're going to be getting Asian Americans and Latinos who are going to be featured in a lot of the Marvel films. And we've seen this a little bit with Spider-Man Homecoming, where it's now, you know, it's set in Queens, and it shows a Queens that looks like everyday Queens that we see in New York, And so the hope is that we see Kamala Khan next March in Captain Marvel.
Wow. Thank you for that look at films, the upcoming films, and the Oscars tomorrow. Thank you so much, Shilpa Dave, Media Studies Professor at the University of Virginia.
Thanks, Ellen and Nancy. I appreciate being invited here.
And
thanks.
Feel free to stick around. Are you going to stick around?
Yes, I'll be here.
Oh, cool. Okay. So we have in our studio Dr. Michael D. Williams. He is a director of the University of Virginia Center for Health Policy and the Associate Professor of Surgery in the School of Medicine. He's also the Director of Emergency General Surgery, and he directs the Summer Medical Leadership Program for students of underrepresented groups and disadvantaged backgrounds. Before joining academia, though, he was chief medical officer for the Washington, D.C. Fire and EMS Department. He's got 20 years of experience in healthcare delivery and systems design. Today, we're going to talk about health policy, health equity, both here in the U.S. and globally, and why this issue is important to everyone. Welcome, Dr. Williams.
Thank you, and so sorry for being late.
That's okay.
It's okay. We're on it.
I'm glad you found us, though.
Yeah. Me too.
Yes. So tell us about the focus of the center that you work for.
Well, we are in the process of building a collaboration across campus or across grounds, as we refer to it here at UVA, of faculty who study issues related to health policy within an equity lens. So when I agreed to take the position, I told the two deans that I work for, and I should point out that you should never have two deans. If you can, just have one. That I would do this on condition that we had a conversation over many years about how we achieve health equity through health policy change.
So what role is the center playing in healthcare reform? What are their goals?
So we are a research center principally, and we're building our educational portfolio, which is, I think, the other piece of what we're trying to do. But the principal effort we're involved in now is doing analysis of existing policy, beginning to study proposed policies that may or may not impact patients directly, and eventually we all become patients. So when I say patients, I mean people. And making sure that the policymakers, as well as those who are the recipients of those policy decisions, and all of us in this country, understand the implications of the decisions that are being made in state houses and in the White House and on the Hill in D.C.,
So based on your answer about, you know, the conditions for becoming the director of the Center for Health Policy, why are you so passionate about health equity?
Well, it's an easy conversation to actually segue onto the earlier conversation you guys had on the program. The challenges that we face as a country in terms of the inequities that are hundreds of years old, literally, and how people of color and other minorities have been treated are most, I think, horribly manifest in terms of the disparities in health care outcomes that we see in this country. And one of the things that we are in the process of doing is at the center is digging into the legacy of policy decisions that may have and continue to lead to those disparities. So if you look critically at the decisions to expand Medicaid across the country and the states that chose to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and those that didn't, there's a rather significant correlation between states that fought for the Confederacy and those that didn't. So you can almost map them state by state for those that chose to expand versus those that didn't. A really good example of why policy matters in this space includes Louisiana, which Bobby Jindal for many, many years was a strident anti-Affordable Care Act antagonist is probably the right word. The new governor ran a campaign of I'm going to expand Medicaid as my first act, which won the day in Louisiana, which is interesting. Louisiana is the state that is I trained there for 5 years. I can tell you it's not a state that's particularly progressive in most of its thinking. But the people of Louisiana recognized that they had a gap to solve and to overcome. And Louisiana is part of a belt of states that have pretty poor health outcomes across the board. And essentially, the governor's campaign was, my first act will be to expand Medicaid, and that's what won the day. So all of a sudden, Louisiana was one of the states that did expand Medicaid overnight, literally. So policy matters, and I think, as we've done some work in the center, there's pretty good data that suggests that if you can limp along to age 65, then the disparities in health outcomes and life expectancy begin to narrow. And the reason that is that at 65, if you're American, you get Medicare, which is colorblind. So all of a sudden, you have an insurance product in your pocket that every provider in the country, with very few exceptions, will accept, and it's portable. So this is part of what the impetus behind the Affordable Care Act was to expand some kind of health care coverage to everybody. And if you're not part of the marketplace and market forces that are often talked about on Wall Street, don't affect you because you're not in the market. So the Affordable Care Act was and remains, for the moment, an attempt to get us all to a state. I know that Bernie Sanders ran a campaign that suggested that Medicare for all was the answer. I'm not sure, honestly, we can afford that as a country. That's a huge amount of money. But if we can get Medicaid for all those who don't qualify for Medicare or commercial insurance, then we'll be 100% better off than we were 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Do you think Trump and the GOP, do you think they're done weakening the ACA?
Not by a long shot.
They're finished?
No, not by a long shot. There's a lot more they can do. And in terms of appropriations, you don't have to kill a law to make it fail. And so that's what we're seeing now is the ability to fund. And we saw this at this open enrollment period, the attempts to undermine the enrollment process to take the websites down days earlier than should have been. In spite of the fact that there were still record numbers of Americans who enrolled and still something like one in three folks who do have coverage through the Affordable Care Act are very concerned they're going to lose it because of the actions of this administration and members of his party.
Does the weakness does it hurt people who don't think they're affected by these policies?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the biggest ironies of the more strident voices you hear from very, very ultra-conservative positions. They are in that same belt of states that need Medicare and that have terrible health outcomes. Unfortunately, poverty is a great leveler for a lot of these things. And so if you live at or close to the poverty level, your skin color becomes less relevant in terms of health outcomes. Poverty and all the other social factors that go into health status across the globe, frankly, are pretty colorblind. So it doesn't matter if you're brown or pink or yellow. If you're poor, you're all kind of in the same boat. A lot of white people are voting against their interests when they say, I'm not going to take that government assistance. I'll wait till Medicare comes along, which, of course, is the height of irony.
Mm-hmm. And has their alternate ways, rather than, as you said, changing the laws, they can do it. They've done other things to weaken the ACA. Has that adjusted your focus of making of what health care reform should be the focus?
So I think it yes and no. On the one hand, the discussions that we've had around the country in the last 10 years or so about health care reform really have to do with health and insurance reform. And that is an ongoing discussion. That's really where I think the Trump administration and those who believe as he does are really focusing their efforts is to see if they can't make market forces so unfavorable for insurers and for providers like UVA to participate in this same space that the market dries up. If the market dries up, then the patient care disappears along with it. On the other hand, I think what we're seeing, and this is one of the beauties and the most resilient aspects of the Affordable Care Act, is it really began a conversation around this country, at least, that's been going on in Europe for many years, and that is to start talking more about the health of populations as well as opposed to individuals, sort of the encounter-based care that I learned, frankly, in medical school here and in practice to this day, versus looking at what are the social factors that are infecting entire populations, affecting entire populations. And how do we go about mitigating those? So health systems like EVA and others around the country have really now had to refocus their efforts outside of our walls. We have to look at what's the built environment of a given community based on a set of health outcomes. What is the status of the water supply? Is it clean? I give you Flint, Michigan as an example of a health system failed initially, but happily, you know, a pediatrician sounded the alarm, and now we were aware of that problem in Flint. It isn't the only place, I guarantee you, but for health systems to, as I had this conversation yesterday, to continue to play catch, as in baseball analogy, if you're playing catcher, you're waiting for whatever comes to you. That's what we've done in the U.S. healthcare system for 100 years, is wait till people have disease, treat the disease, get better at that, find better ways to do a nicer operation with more expensive technologies. What we have to do is begin to be the manager and strategize how not to get ourselves in the position where we're playing catch. And so that's what's happening, and the Affordable Care Act really was the impetus for that national change.
That is a helpful analogy, actually. So if I may ask you, can you step back just to explain population health more? Because I don't think I get it yet.
Yeah. So population health as a construct essentially says that, and again, this is actually a language that's baked into the Affordable Care Act, that health systems and physician practices, which may be a one-person practice or a multi-specialty group of hundreds, will take responsibility for the health outcomes of an entire population. So it isn't necessarily that we're going to take accountability or responsibility for all of Charlottesville. But for those patients who are, in this case, Medicare recipients who get their care primarily, looking backward through time at UVA, UVA was part of what's called an accountable care organization structure, and there are ACOs which were defined and codified in the Affordable Care Act. And essentially, the government said that for the Medicare recipients that you take care of, in our case, there were 21,000 lives or so that we were responsible for, you're responsible for their health outcome, period. And you should do whatever you have to do to make sure that they do well. We're going to set several metrics in place, and we're going to come back in a year and 2 years and 3 years of your contract to say, did you meet those metrics? If you meet those metrics, then as an ACO, there is an incentive payment that came to health systems and practices that chose to go the ACO route. But to do that, we quickly learned, those of us who pay attention to this space, that you can't play a catch. You really have to get into the preventive healthcare business in a big way. You have to redefine your practice model. So patients need to be able to access healthcare on their terms and not ours. So we need, you know, Saturday and evening hours for primary care clinics, urgent care availability in places that never had it. The emergency room is a terrible place to get healthcare unless you absolutely have to be there. You know, as I often tell my students, what's the number of times anybody should be in an ambulance in their lifetime? Answer, zero. What's the number of times you should be in the emergency department in your lifetime? Answer, zero. So the population health construct is that we would take a more holistic look at what we do in terms of healthcare in this country and mimic what, frankly, has been done in Europe. So, you know, one of the things that we didn't say explicitly in the ramp up to the ACA, but really have been looking at more meaningfully here at UVA, and I know around the country other places are doing the same, is, and I mentioned this earlier, what are the social factors that go into making up a health outcome for an individual or a community? It turns out that that's somewhere in the neighborhood of half of your health outcomes are driven by things that have nothing to do with whether you got your vaccine or whether you run exercise every day because your doctor said so. It really has to do, as I said, with things like the quality of the air that you live in, the amount of violence you're exposed to on a daily basis. Do you have access to healthy foods? And by access, I mean, is it affordable? And can you get to affordable healthy foods? The social determinants of health really have become much more in the forefront of the thinking of health systems around the country, including ours. The Affordable Care Act really drove us to begin to have those conversations in this country, but I'm embarrassed to say that Western Europe figured this out a long, long time ago. So we spend a great deal of our, and this is, you know, this is not news to anyone, we spend a great deal of our money in U.S. GDP terms on healthcare. That's healthcare delivery. We spend a relatively small fraction of our money on social factors like environmental safety, access to safe spaces to exercise, food desert mitigation, those kinds of things. Well, Europe spends a great deal of money on those things. Europe has better health outcomes than we have across the board. There's not very, very few European countries that don't beat us in terms of health outcomes. But if you look at the overall money spent on both sectors, so healthcare delivery as well as social services, it's about even. So we're spending our money in the wrong place is the moral of the story.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being here. I'm really glad you got here because that was really interesting. Dr. Michael D. Williams, director of the University of Virginia Center for Health Policy, a joint program of the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, the School of Medicine, and the Department of Public Health Sciences. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back.
Yeah.
We'd love to. Now
we
know where it is.
Now you know where we are, exactly. So, Nancy, do you want to squeeze in like a few news of note or a palate cleanser?
Well, at this point, since you're asking my choice, I'm going to do a palate cleanser, so I'm going to wait for you to do that thing.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. In lieu of the Oscars tomorrow, I bring you this news. Winning aside, there are three Oscar nominations that are already firsts. One is for her work in Mudbound. Cinematographer Rachel Morrison is the first woman ever to be nominated in this category.
Shilpa's giving you the thumbs up on that.
Huh?
Shilpa's giving you the thumbs up. Yep, she's totally.
Exactly. She knows all of these. And then also Mudbound's writer-director Dee Reese is the first woman to be nominated in that category of Best Adapted Screenplay. And lastly, also Mudbound, Mary J. Blige, first person to be nominated in 1 year for an acting award and best original song, Mighty River.
Fantastic.
So what do you got?
I was just going to talk about the at sign that in 1971, Ray Tomlinson, he brought it back from, I guess, there's lots of theories about where the at symbol came from, but he was developing a messaging system for the early ancestor of the modern internet called ARPANET, and he was inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame in 2012 for doing that. And we're out of time, Nancy. We'll have more next week on Apropos.
We had an Internet Hall of Fame. Okay.
I know.
Yes,
we'll have more.
We're out of time.
We'll have more for everybody next week. Thanks, Nance.
Yep. Thank you.